of my life. No one escaped punishment. Pavel Litvinov was sentenced to 5 years in internal exile. He was sent to live in a remote village in Siberia, not far from where the rebel Decembrists had been imprisoned more than a century before. After he returned home to Moscow, Pavel saw that he faced an unavoidable choice: jail or exile abroad. If he continued his human rights work, and he could not do otherwise, he would be sentenced this time to a prison camp, a far more severe fate than he had known in Siberia. An application for emigration, a KGB officer suggested to him, would likely meet with a positive response. Pavel said his farewells to his friends and family at a bleak party in 1973. "I thought that when I left the country it was forever, and that I would never see my parents again," Pavel said. "This was a typical experience for many people. You left, and for you the people you were leaving behind were as good as dead. They were alive, but you lost them the way you lose people when they die." Pavel and Maya Litvinov began a new life in the United States. Pavel found a job teaching at the Hackley School, a small private school in Tarrytown, New York. They traveled. They met new friends. But for years they lived in a painful limbo. Pavel Litvinov had gone through a transformation, from obedience to independence, that had cost him his family, his home. Most of those he had left behind did not have the means or the chance to win their independence. The Soviet Union was no longer what it was under Stalin. But even with the prison camps in ruins, the system survived. The fear remained, and no one was free. In nearly 4 years of living and traveling in what was once the Soviet Union, I often found myself wandering accidentally into old prison camps. During the first strikes in the Siberian coal fields in 1989, some miners in the Siberian city of Kemerovo told me to look over a fence and into a field. That low set of buildings to the left of the cows. Barracks. In a working prison outside the city of Perm in the Urals, I had tea and cookies with the commandant. He had buried a few dissidents in his time, and now he was thinking about his pension. At one time, the entire country was part of the camp system, the Gulag Archipelago, as Solzhenitsyn called it, and you did not have to travel far from home to see it. One evening I was drinking tea and visiting an old man in an apartment house on Leninsky Prospect, just down the street from where I lived in Moscow. "I've always felt honored to live here," the man said. The apartment was just one room, and the heat was off and the plumbing was rotting. "Why, what honor can there be in living here?" I asked him. "Solzhenitsyn helped build this dump," he said, his gold incisors flashing. "He was on the prisoner's crew when they put this place up." At every one of these meetings, it was not hard for me to feel at once connected to the place, and lucky to have escaped it. Both my grandfathers, Alex and Ben, were born around the same time and in the same sort of place. They lived in muddy villages around the turn of the century. Alex, outside Vilna, now Vilnius, Ben, outside Kiev. Neither village, so far as I have been able to determine, still exists. Neither of my grandfathers knew much, or wanted to know much, of his boyhood in the Russian Empire. They were bewildered in old age by the craze for roots. There was no nostalgia in them. They were lucky to have escaped. Upon hearing the rumors of pogroms, they fled Russia on foot, on horseback, on wagon, and finally on a ship. They came to Castle Garden and Ellis Island. Alex sold notions in New York, girdle snaps, nylons, hairpins at a corner store on Prince Street and Broadway. Ben worked as a salesman in clothing stores in Paterson, New Jersey. When I began learning Russian in high school, My grandfather smiled with curiosity and let it go at that. If they knew 7 or 8 words of Russian, it was a lot. For them, Russia was a burning house they had fled in the middle of the night. Just before I left for Russia, I flew to Miami Beach. Ben had managed to trade in his house in Patterson for a small room with a view of the Atlantic Ocean and an ambulance in the basement garage. He was 100 years old. When I told him I was planning to live in Moscow for 3 or 4 years, he said, "You must be crazy. We almost got killed going out, and you, Miss Sugar, you want to go back in." My wife's family was even more suspicious of our going to Moscow, and with good reason. They were less successful at escape. Esther's grandfather, Simon, was a renowned rabbi, born in Byelorussia. After taking a pulpit in Poland, he married Nechama, the descendant of 7 generations of rabbis. Robinson was her maiden name, son of rabbis. Eventually he moved back to Byelorussia, where he was both a rabbi and a teacher of philosophy in the local gymnasium. In 1939, an officer of the NKVD secret police came through the town of Diezna looking for Simon. The townspeople and congregants refused to give him up. But when Simon found out about the agent, he sought him out and invited him to his home. When the agent arrived at the door, he said something strange. "If you don't mind," he said to the terrified family, "I'd like to pray with you first." When they were finished praying, it became clear that the NKVD man was a kind of double agent, or at least an agent with a hint of mercy. He told Simon that the police were after him. "You must leave," he said. "Leave now with just the clothes on your back." Simon fled to independent Lithuania, and his wife and children soon followed. But in June 1940, just days after the Soviet occupation of Lithuania, he was arrested and jailed for 6 months in Vilna. Then he was deported to a labor camp in the town of Sukhobez Vodnoye, meaning dry without water, in the Urals. He was never heard from again. As relatives of an enemy of the people, Nechama and her children, Murray, Rita, and the baby, Esther's mother, Miriam, were all deported to Siberia. Nechama was put to work on a collective farm. When she refused to let her son go into the army, she claimed Polish citizenship, the two of them were arrested and jailed. Rita, at 14, was left to fend for herself, and Miriam was put into a children's camp in western Siberia. After the war, Miriam and her sister, brother, and mother fled Russia. For the longest time, Esther's grandmother refused to speak of the past. By the time Esther began to insist that she needed to know what had happened, Nechama could no longer think clearly. Her mind moved in and out of time, from one language to another. 3 months after we were married, Esther and I moved to Moscow. "I hope you come home once in a while," Miriam said, "because I don't think I could visit you there." Chapter 3. To be preserved forever. In the years after Stalin's death, the state was an old tyrant slouched in the corner with cataracts and gallstones, his muscles gone slack. He wore plastic shoes and a shiny suit that stank of sweat. He hogged all the food and fouled his pants. Mornings his tongue was coated with the ash taste of age. He mumbled and didn't care. His thoughts drifted like storm clouds and came clear only a few times a year to recite the old legends of Great October and the Great Patriotic War. Sometimes, in the gathering dark of his office, he would set out on the green baize table all the gifts that foreigners had given him. The gold cigarette dispenser, the silver Eiffel Tower, the colored pens, the crystal paperweights. The state was nearly senile, but still dangerous enough. He still kept the key to the border gate in his pocket and ruled every function of public life. Now and then he had fits, and the world trembled. But how the state kept alive, how it got from day to day, was a mystery. History was a fairy tale, and the mechanisms of daily life a vast Rube Goldberg machine that somehow, if just barely, kept moving. If not for the plundering of Soviet oil fields and the worldwide energy crisis, the economy might have collapsed even before it did. And by the early 1980s, KGB reports declared that the cushion of oil profits was all but gone. "The abyss awaits us," the most trenchant of the secret police reports declared. The economy was doomed. Nothing and no one worked in any recognized sense of the word. I saw the serfs of a collective farm outside Vologda in northern Russia herded onto buses to buy their food in the city. Their own harvest had rotted in the rain. In the steel town of Magnitogorsk, I saw miners spending their breaks at a local clinic sucking on oxygen cocktails, a liquid concoction infused with oxygen and vitamins. On Sakhalin Island, north of Japan, I saw a few hundred thousand salmon, fish that could have sold on the Ginza or Broadway for a fortune, writhe and rot in the shoreline nets while the trawlers sat rusting in port. Sakhalin is closer on the map to Hollywood Boulevard than Red Square, but the fishermen couldn't make a move until they get the telegram from Moscow, a local politician told me. The order from the ministry came a week after the salmon had gone white and belly up. But somehow the state never completely collapsed. There was bread, at least, and parades marked the triumph of the state's persistence. Even the May Day parade of 1988 was not much different from those before them. I stood in the reporters' section just to the right of the Lenin mausoleum and watched the leaders come out looking faintly embarrassed, but pleased as well that it was all hanging together. Lenin's edgy portrait still hung on the side wall of GUM, the State Department store. Strong men heaved dumbbells and gymnasts skipped through hoops in a show of physical culture. The workers of the Moscow automobile plants carried the banners they received in the morning and drank down the vodka they got at parade's end. Only the music changed. Pete Seeger songs boomed out of the Kremlin loudspeakers as the workers of the Zeal automobile factory marched by the reviewing stand. As Sergei Ivanov, a Soviet scholar of the Byzantine period, wrote, "The rites of communism had their roots in Constantinople, when the leaders' rare appearances before the people were accompanied by thoroughly rehearsed outbursts of delight, specially selected crowds who chanted the officially approved songs." It was Oz, the world's longest-running and most colossal mistake, and the only way to endure it all was the perfection of irony. There was no other way to live. Even the sweetest-seeming grandmother, her hair in a babushka and her bulk packed into a housecoat, even she was possessed of a sense of irony that would chill the spine of any absurdist at the café floor. One morning I was sitting in a courtyard in Moscow talking with an ancient of the city, a sweet wreck of a man. He needed help desperately, and it was still a time when a foreigner seemed the last recourse for everything from KGB harassment to this man's problem. His wife was dying of leukemia. How could he get to the Mayo Clinic? He'd heard the doctors there were beautiful. They could save his wife. As he talked, I happened to glance up over his shoulder and saw a woman on the 10th floor hurl a cat out her kitchen window. "Animal!" she screamed. "No room for you here. Be gone!" The cat hit the pavement, and it sounded like the soft pop of an exploding water balloon. Now the two of us, the old man and I, were watching. The woman at the window, her face twisted into an angry knot, the cat struggling to get up on its broken legs. "Ah," the old man said, turning away. our Russian life. His smile was like the smile on a skull. He went on talking. In an era of rot, the laureate was a genius of irony and part-time drunk named Venedikt Benny Yerofiev. In the 70s, Yerofiev's friends circulated a masterpiece, a modern dead souls called Moskva Petushki, the name of a train route between the capital and a town where many people lived after they returned from the camps. Yerofiev's book, published in English as Moscow Circles, is a novel of wandering that goes nowhere except down, deep into the soul of man under socialism. His greatest relief is in the mastery of the binge. He is an artful mixologist. When there is no real vodka at hand, he conjures, with nail varnish and lavender water, the tears of the Komsomol girl. After one glass, your memory is as strong as ever, but your mind just goes blank. After the second glass, the brightness of your mind amazes you, but your memory goes blank. His best recipe, the Finnish Coronat Opus, is catgut. 100 grams of Zhigulov beer, 30 grams of Sadko, the Rich Merchant, brand shampoo, 70 grams of anti-dandruff shampoo, and 20 grams of insect repellent. And now your catgut is ready. Drink it from early evening in large gulps. After two glasses of this, men become so inspired, you can spit at them from 5 feet for half an hour, and they won't take the blindest bit of notice. Yerofiev made his living at any job he could keep. He didn't keep them long, generally, but he did rise to the post of foreman. He commanded a small brigade of men who were laying cable, or pretending to, in the town of Sheremetyevo, outside Moscow. This is what we would do. One day we would play poker. The next day we would drink vermouth. On the third day we'd play poker, and on the fourth day it was back to vermouth. For a while everything was perfect. We'd send off our socialist pledges once a month, and we'd get our pay twice a month. We'd write, for example, "On the occasion of the coming centenary, we pledge ourselves to end production traumatization." Or, "In honor of the glorious anniversary, we will struggle to ensure that every sixth worker takes a correspondence course in a higher educational institution." Traumatization. Institutions! Oh, what freedom and equality! What fraternity and freeloading! Oh, the joy of non-accountability! Oh, blessed hours in the life of my people! The hours which stretch from opening to closing time! Free of shame and idle care, we lived a life that was purely spiritual. The state, of course, did not allow this sort of thing. Moskva Petushki was published only in 1988, and then only by a temperance journal. But the state never got the joke with Yerofiev. Otherwise, he would have been jailed or exiled. Let him laugh. What it could not tolerate was a challenge uncomplicated by irony. When Brezhnev shoved Khrushchev out of power, the state still had the means to squash what little freedom it had allowed. The censors went through the libraries with razor blades and slashed from the bound copies of Novy Mir Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Then they slashed Solzhenitsyn from Russia, hustling him from a prison cell to a jet and finally to his exile. It could not tolerate Solzhenitsyn's sneer, Brodsky's impudence, or Sakharov's superiority. The regime would rather kill its brightest children than give way. A magnificent life support system, with millions of agents, informers, police, wardens, lawyers, and judges all working at its bedside, kept the old tyrant breathing. Their watchfulness was admirable. "Every life has a file, if you will," Brodsky told me in his basement apartment, his New York exile. "The moment you get a little bit well-known, they open a file on you. The file begins to get filled up with this and that. and if you write, your file grows in size all the faster. It's sort of a Neanderthal form of computerization. Gradually, your file occupies too much space on the shelf, and, quite simply, a man walks into the office and says, "This is a big file. Let's get him." They got him. At his trial in Leningrad, Brodsky encountered the soul of the regime, its peculiar language. Judge: "What is your profession?" Brodsky: "Translator and poet." Judge: "Who recognized you as a poet? Who has enrolled you in the ranks of poets?" Brodsky: "No one. Who enrolled me in the ranks of human beings?" Judge: "Did you study for it?" Brodsky: "What?" Judge: "To be a poet. Didn't you try to take courses in school where one prepares for life, where one learns?" Brodsky: "I didn't believe it was a matter of education." Judge: "How is that?" Brodsky: "I thought that it came from God." Just before he left the country in 1972, Brodsky adopted an old Russian tradition and wrote a letter to the Tsar. "Dear Leonid Ilyich, a language is a much more ancient and inevitable thing than a state. I belong to the Russian language. As for the state, from my point of view, the measure of a writer's patriotism is not oaths from a high platform, but how he writes in the language of the people among whom he lives. Although I am losing my Soviet citizenship, I do not cease to be a Russian poet. I believe that I will return. Poets always return in the flesh or on paper." Brodsky's letter, Sakharov's manifestos, all the broadsides and masterworks of the dissidents carried with them the air of futility. The idea of change, of the resiliency of the word against the state, seemed a kind of dream, a conceit to live out the day and get to the next one. Just before his exile, Solzhenitsyn wrote his letter to the Soviet leaders. "Your dearest wish," he informed them, "is for our state structure and our ideological system never to change, to remain as they are for centuries. But history is not like that. Every system either finds a way to develop or else it collapses." And with that, Solzhenitsyn was gone. Lydia Chukovskaya, who wrote a novel about the purges while she waited in vain for her husband to return from a prison camp, got up at a meeting of the Writers' Union at the height of the anti-dissident campaign and said, "I can prophesy that in the capital city of our homeland there will inevitably be an Alexander Solzhenitsyn Square and an academician Andrei Sakharov Avenue." Inevitably. Who believed it? Even the bravest of the brave, and Chukovskaya was among them, had their doubts. When I met her, she was in her 90s and living with her daughter, Yelena, on Gorky Street. Yelena greeted me at the door and asked me to wait a moment until Lydia Korneyevna was ready to receive me. There was nothing royal about this, nothing vain, but rather a woman gathering herself. Yelena led me into the room, and Lydia Korneyevna was seated at a small table. There was a teapot and two cups with chipped saucers and a plate of cookies. Her hand was already on the handle of the pot. Lydia Korneyevna had not been well. Her wide, light eyes were glazed with rheum. The skin of her face was fine, a kind of papery white, as if it would burn if you touched it. Like all Moscow intellectuals of a certain kind and class, she had photographs of well-known poets and writers stuck behind the glass of her bookshelves. In many apartments, this is both a vanity and a connection, a way of announcing one's sense of quality and aspiration. Lydia Korneyevna had no vanity, and no one deserved the portraits of Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov more than she did. She had risked all to defend them. She had lost the right to publish. Probably all that kept her safe in her bed was her age and the fact that she was the daughter of Korney Chukovsky, a children's writer as revered in Russia as Dr. Seuss is in America. For a while she talked about her friends, her walks with Anna Akhmatova in Leningrad, her love for Sakharov. Her sentences were formal and clear, and her voice, though weakened with age, had a liquid sound. Then the lights went out in the entire apartment block. It was night, and there was no moon, and the room was black. Lydia Korneyevna could hardly tell. To her it was like the slight change of light in a room when the fire settles into itself. And, not noticing, she kept talking. After a while she did sense some difference, a change in the air, a certain coolness and quiet. Her mood changed. For a moment she paused, as if she were finally going to mention the darkness. Then she said, "You know, when we talk about all these people, I know now that they are all gone. It is horrible to say, but you must imagine a state that used every means to kill the best among us. All dead or all gone." After a while, Lydia Korneyevna said, "The lights, they're out. How strange." Yelena came in with candles, and we continued talking until Lydia Korneyevna announced, "I suppose I'm tired." On the way out, I told Yelena a little of what her mother had said. She nodded. She had heard this many times before. "But you must remember," she said, "even Lydia Korneyevna has hope. She adores that young boy, Dmitri Yorosov. She adores him. You should meet him if you can." While the world spent 1987 and 1988 waiting for Gorbachev's newest initiatives, his shifts in ideology, the boldest ideas for the creation of a civil society were debated on Saturday mornings in Moscow. At first, small groups of young intellectuals, the informals, met at home and even typed out their declarations on onion-skin paper. But after a while, the older voices gathered. Sakharov had returned from exile, and Moscow Tribune, a loose amalgamation of scholars and writers who all had lived through the promise of the thaw, was one of his regular platforms. The first time I saw Dmitri Yorosov was at a Saturday morning session of Moscow Tribune at Dom Kino, the headquarters of the Filmmakers Union near the Peking Hotel. The scene was nearly always the same. Moscow Tribune's sessions would begin at 10 or 11 with speeches by the best-known of the group. Yuri Afanasyev, a bearish-looking historian of the French Annales School, who had been put in charge of the Historical Archives Institute. Yuri Karyakin, a journalist and Dostoevsky scholar who nearly drank himself to death during the Brezhnev years. Nikolai Shmelyov, an economist and short story writer who had once been a member of the Khrushchev family by marriage. Leonid Batkin, a scholar of the Italian Renaissance whose slight heresies and refusal to join the party prevented him from teaching in Moscow. Galina Starovoitova, a demographer, an expert on Armenia. Len Karpinsky, the son of revolutionaries, a journalist who had once been blessed by the Kremlin as our great hope, and later betrayed it by becoming what he called a half-dissident. And always there was Sakharov, off to the side, sleeping through the speeches at times, clearly weakened by his years of forced exile in Gorky, but ready to perform when it came his turn. Yorosov was sitting in the back rows. He was 24 years old and the youngest person in the hall. He was a tough-looking kid in ratty jeans and a bleached jacket. His hair was cropped close. He looked like an army recruit on leave. When one of the speakers said something not to his liking, he sneered. as if rehearsing to be James Dean. Dimitri, or Dima, as everyone called him, was known as the young kid who collected information on people who had been imprisoned or executed under Soviet power. He kept the names on index cards, and he had about 200,000 of them. That is, 200,000 out of tens of millions. Moscow Tribune meetings never really ended. Instead, after a few hours, they sort of trailed off like smoke. The first string speakers had left for home, and even Afanasyev, who was the radical left's master of ceremonies, was getting ready to leave. I offered Yurasov a ride home. "Wait here just a second," he said, when we got to his apartment. I heard him inside, frantically throwing papers into order. This was a futile effort. He led me to his room, a tiny place with journals and magazines in 5-foot stacks on the floor. On the wall there were a few posters of rock stars, and a calendar with a photograph of a sexy girl from Brazil, who looked as though she had just had 3 drinks and a bad meal. "Before we start," Dima said, "you should read this." He handed me a short stack of letters. "Respected Dmitry Gennadievich, my father Afonin, Timofey Stepanovich, lived in the town of Tolmachevo in the Novosibirsk region. As I remember it, he was a member of the local military party committee and was chairman of the farm council. In 1930 he was arrested by the NKVD together with other residents of the village and taken to Novosibirsk. In the court documents of the military intelligence, he was judged guilty of Article 58.8.10 and 73.1 of the Russian Criminal Code and sentenced to be shot. On February 13, 1930, the sentence was carried out." There were many such letters in his files. People now in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, telling the stories of their parents who had disappeared, the sketchy details of their arrests, the open questions. Finally, Dima handed me a short note, a testimonial from a woman who had written to him asking if he knew anything at all about her dead father. In his catalogue, Dima found my father's name. He named the place of his imprisonment and evidently his death. Dima showed me that one of the investigators into my father's rehabilitation had said my father was a librarian. Was this some arbitrary thing he did in his camps, or his real profession? I don't know. But something changed inside me. From the anonymous gray mass of pea jackets, my father had emerged as a particular man, a special man. Not all were called librarians. A father. I have a father. "Now maybe you can see what I do," Dima said, taking back the letters. Dmitry Yurasov was born in 1964, the year that hardline forces and Stalinist revivalists in the Kremlin toppled Khrushchev for the heresy of voluntarism. Next to the Litvinovs, the Yurasovs were an unremarkable family. They lived in a cramped apartment on Leninsky Prospect and worked as mid-level engineers. They read no samizdat and did not care to. Dima's mother, Ludmila, grew up singing paeans to Stalin. "I'm a little girl. I dance and sing. I've never seen Stalin, but I love him so." She joined the Communist Party, not so much out of an overwhelming sense of conviction, but rather as a mark of distinction, a way to advance at work. Like every other Soviet schoolboy, like Pavel Litvinov, Dima grew up outside of history and deep within the mythologies of his time. He was trained from the earliest age to become a Soviet man. This was a matter of policy, one that had altered very little since Stalin's death. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union proceeds, and has always proceeded, from the premise that the formation of the new man is the most important component of the entire task of communist construction, said Mikhail Suslov, one of the leaders of the plot to overthrow Khrushchev and Brezhnev's ideologist. In their first year of medical school, students were informed that there were two species of human beings, Homo sapiens and Homo sovieticus. As a schoolboy, Dima sat through his lessons in the latter. He learned to read using primers that substituted Grandpa Ilyich Lenin for Dick and Jane. His history lessons were a litany of garlanded triumphs, beginning with the revolution and ending with record harvests in the Black Earth Zone. Summers, Dina went to young pioneers' camp, outposts that taught the virtues of military discipline and the supremacy of the group over the individual. But Dima Yorosov also had a young mind that was somehow, innocently, subversive. Even in the fifth and sixth grade, he read constantly in the 16-volume Soviet Historical Encyclopedia, books written by party historians and ideologists, and approved by a hierarchy of censors. There were approved articles on the Revolution, the Civil War, the Great Patriotic War, each one an instruction in the pseudo-theology that the study of history had become decades before. On rare occasions, evidence of the thaw under Khrushchev washed up on the page. The censors, it turned out, could not catch everything. One day, when he was 11 years old, Dima was reading about a scholar who had been, the encyclopedia said, illegally repressed and rehabilitated after his death. Dima had never seen such a phrase. It was as strange to him as a sentence in Burmese. Dima asked his mother for an explanation. She brushed it off. This was nearly two decades after Khrushchev's secret speech denouncing the crimes of the Stalin era, and yet the atmosphere of neo-Stalinism was so pervasive that ordinary people, even in the relatively sophisticated city of Moscow, were not prepared to talk to their children about the nightmares of the past. They themselves knew so little about it. Khrushchev's speech, after all, had never been published in the Soviet Union, and much of the literature that came out during the thaw period had been pulled from library shelves. And so Dima set out to learn history on his own. He went slowly through the volumes of the great Soviet encyclopedia and wrote down the names of all those generals and politicians and artists who had died in 1937, 1938, 1939, 1940, the years of the Great Terror. The cause of death was almost never listed. For each name, Dima set up an index card and filled out the most rudimentary information. It was a game, a mystery. A little like stamp collecting, he said. Like the way kids imagine they've gone to Yemen or the Sudan when they've found the stamp. It was a sense of connection to something I had only the vaguest ideas about. And what was strangest, I couldn't really talk to anyone about it. During the day, Dima was a good enough student and excelled in history as it was taught. He could recite with ease the mythology of the country he lived in. He was obedient and enjoyed the teacher's praise that his good memory won for him. In the evenings and weekends, Dima filled out his cards with the names of the disappeared. He had little idea what to make of this strange phenomenon, but his catalogue of the disappeared continued to grow. Then there was this breakthrough, he said. While I was in the eighth grade, I read in the papers the minutes of the 22nd Party Congress, where Khrushchev gave more body and detail to his denunciation of the Stalinist terror. When that happened, the game changed. It wasn't a game. At first it was just these strange names that seemed to disappear at a certain point in history. Then it became a matter of their fates. It was becoming more obvious to me what had happened to these people. In high school, Dima signed up for the History Olympiad, an academic contest sponsored by the Young Communist League. A lot of the questions were on the order of, who was the first boy to join the YCL? And how many medals and honors did he win? Stuff like that. But there were questions that went a little deeper. I decided to win. He went to study at the Central State Archive of the October Revolution. Dima met one of the directors there and asked about a few issues related to the contest. He had also brought along his stack of index cards, a stack that was growing by the hundreds as he made his way through the encyclopedias. He was hoping for more information.
"What do you want to know?" asked the director.
"I want to know whether these people were repressed or killed," Dima said. The woman lowered her eyes. Her voice dropped nearly to a whisper.
"We'll answer questions about the Komsomol," she said, "but we needn't talk of these people you are talking about. It is unnecessary."
The woman was in her mid-40s and not at all cruel in what she said or how she said it. Instead, it seemed to Dima that she knew only that these were forbidden things and must not be spoken of. She was terrified. When Dima was 17, he decided to apply for both work and study at the Historical Archives Institute. His mother was baffled and wondered why he didn't try for a more prestigious place. Dima said very little. He kept his passion well hidden, not so much because he enjoyed the secret, but rather because he was no longer a boy. He knew how dangerous his interest could be for those around him. To win a post at the Institute, Dima had to take an entrance exam. Around that time, he had read in Samizdat Solzhenitsyn's essay, "Live Not by the Lie." The essay recognized the difficulty, even the impossibility, of outright rebellion in a totalitarian state. Instead, it implored the reader at least to refuse cooperation in the lies of the state. Better not to be a journalist than to write the lies of Pravda. Better not to teach history at all than to read the short course to young minds. Preserve yourself, even if you cannot save the world. But at his entrance exam, Dima found himself writing an essay that extolled the sham autobiography of Leonid Brezhnev, The Little Land, which was filled with heroic exploits that had never actually taken place. Brezhnev never even wrote the book, and yet he rewarded himself with the year's top literary prize, a spectacle not unlike Ronald Reagan awarding himself the Pulitzer Prize for his own ghostwritten book. "What can I say? I was one more Soviet person who faced a choice and humiliated himself," Dima said. "And you know what? I got a top grade. How wonderful." Dima's job at the Institute was mainly clerical, organizing boxes of documents, counting pages, sorting files. But it was paradise. Alone in a closed room, he had enough time to comb through secret documents and copy out as much information as time allowed on his file cards. Once, when all his fellow workers in the department went out to cash their weekly paychecks, he stayed behind and scanned the files of the NKVD for 1935. He shuddered, remembering the stark sight of those papers. One execution after another. Sometimes they would send me to the basement to find a file, and I'd take 5 minutes to find it and 20 to copy it out. I tried to copy at least 100 files every day. It all proved to me very soon that the great Soviet encyclopedia was a multi-volume lie. The documents testified that people were tortured, that their tongues were burned with cigarettes. People were forced to stand 60 hours in a row just facing a wall. Prisoners were beaten so badly that they had to be carried to the firing squad. There were descriptions of the theater director Meyerhold, how he was forced to drink his own urine,
how his interrogators broke his left arm and forced him to sign his confession with his right. I remember being in shock when I read about how 208 people were shot down in the Dimitrov camp for an alleged attempt on the life of Yezhov, who was on an inspection trip to the camp. There were women, old people. The information was like a nightmare, like being caught in a huge avalanche, and it goes on and never stops. But I didn't make the connections. I couldn't hook it all up with ideology, policy. It was all on the level of the raw accumulation of data about this person and that, and not much more. Dima lost paradise when he was drafted into the army. But even during his 2 years of service, he continued his explorations. He even began writing a novel, The Brothers Kaganovich. The book was based on a well-known incident in Lazar Kaganovich's life. One day, Stalin told Kaganovich that there was evidence against Mikhail, Kaganovich's older brother and the head of the defense industry. Lazar Moiseyevich did not hesitate. "What has to be done must be done," he said. Mikhail Kaganovich was arrested. He killed himself in his jail cell. Late at night, Dima read parts of his manuscript of The Brothers Kaganovich to his buddies. A few days later, he discovered the manuscript was missing from his drawer. His officers had confiscated the papers. The next morning, he was accused of insulting Soviet power, a charge, the officers said, that could lead to a trial and a prison term. Never mind that it had been more than a decade since Kaganovich had been thrown out of the leadership by Khrushchev and reduced to running a concrete factory in the provinces. Never mind that the story of the two brothers was based on fact. These were facts that a young soldier like Private Yorosov had no business knowing. They were, for him, non-facts. The only way out, the officers said, was to write a letter admitting guilt and begging forgiveness. The Soviet system's lust for confession had not changed much since the days of the Terror. Dima wrote the letter and considered himself lucky that the incident ended there. Back in Moscow, it was not easy at first finding a job once more in the archives. The officials at the Historical Archives Institute never actually accused Dima of a crime or wrongdoing, but they had their suspicions. Dima knew he could not go back there and be allowed access to the Spetschkran, the restricted archives. But friends tipped him off to an opening at the archive of the Supreme Court. Somehow, because the secret police apparatus was never quite as efficient as it seemed, he got the job. It was a trove of information that only the highest officials, and the archive workers, could see. In the basements of the Supreme Court were files on 2.5 million criminal cases after 1924. Most of the files had not been touched since the moment they had first been shelved. "This was it," Dima said. "These documents were the only proof that a man or a woman had died or lived." Dima worked mainly in a room designed to prevent just the sort of research he had in mind. There were four desks crammed into a tiny office, all facing one another. That way, no one could do anything without three other people seeing. But still, Dima tried. He accumulated names, facts, the fates of thousands of the lost. After 18 months, he had accumulated 100,000 cards and established a standardized form. 1, last name. 2, first name. 3, middle name. 4, year of birth. 5, year of death. 6, nationality. 7, party status. 8, social background. 9, education. 10, last place of work and status before arrest. 11. Facts of arrest, repression. 12. Facts of rehabilitation. But the workplace system of Stukachi, informers, finally caught up to Dima. One of the bosses found a book of lists in his desk, and there was a search. Once more, Yorosov's quest to recover the lost names of history was over. He was fired. Chapter 4. The Return of History. Dima had good reason to worry. The new Soviet leadership did not come into power with much public daring. 2 months after Mikhail Gorbachev took office in March 1985, he delivered a speech celebrating the 40th anniversary of the victory over Nazi Germany. There he proclaimed that the gigantic work at the front and in the rear was led by the party, its Central Committee, and the State Defense Committee headed by the General Secretary, Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin. This passage inspired ringing applause from the members of the Central Committee. In February 1986, Gorbachev told the French newspaper, L'Humanité, that Stalinism is a concept made up by opponents of communism and used on a large scale to smear the Soviet Union and socialism as a whole. The party, Gorbachev assured L'Humanité, had already drawn the proper conclusions from the past. And finally, in a meeting with Soviet writers in June 1986, Gorbachev said, "If we start trying to deal with the past, we'll lose all our energy. It would be like hitting people over the head. And we have to go forward. We'll sort out the past. We'll put everything in its place. But right now we have to direct our energy forward." Communist Party officials across the country were simply in no mood for full disclosure, even if Gorbachev was. In mid-1987, the local Communist Party boss in Magadan, a city that was once the gateway to the notorious Kolyma labor camps in the Far East, told a group of visiting Western reporters that the issue of the Stalinist purges does not exist here for us. There is no such question. "We lived through that period, and this page in history has been turned," the official, Alexander Bogdanov, said. "It's not necessary to speak constantly about that. Nearly 3 million people were killed in Kolyma alone." Gorbachev, who grew up inside the party bureaucracy, knew well that to lose completely the support of such dinosaurs as Bogdanov, to say nothing of the dinosaurs of the Central Committee, the KGB, the military, and the police, would have meant an immediate end to his leadership. Years later, the liberal mayor of St. Petersburg, Anatoly Sobchak, wrote, "A totalitarian system leaves behind it a minefield built into both the country's social structure and the individual psychology of its citizens. And mines explode each time the system faces the danger of being dismantled and the country sees the prospect of genuine renewal." Whether he relished the task or not, Gorbachev was acting as the keeper of the secrets, the chief curator of the party's criminal history. Just as the Soviet regime combined brutality and the technology of the totalitarian state to leave behind tens of millions of corpses and a perverse social order, it also used the completeness of the state, the pervasiveness of every institution from the kindergartens to the secret police, to put an end to historical inquiry. Stalin was not the first leader to enforce a myth of history, only the most successful. As the scholar Walter Lacour points out, modern historiography, with its demands of integrity and evidence, is less than 200 years old. Pariskop Vilas of the Incan Empire was perhaps the first of many to assemble an official state history on the order of his dictator. In Russia, Nicholas I not only crushed the uprising of the Decembrists, he also tried, with some success, to expunge the threat to his authority from the history books. Stalin inherited the tradition of manipulating human memory, and came closest to perfecting it. For the first 10 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, there had been a degree of coexistence among historians, a debate between Orthodox Marxists and their bourgeois opponents. That all came to an end at the first and last All-Union Conference of Marxist Historians held in 1928, the same year that Stalin became the unchallenged leader of the Bolshevik state. As the conference made clear, Stalin's consolidation of power gave him absolute control over history. In 1934, the Communist Party Central Committee issued a decree calling for a strict ideological version of history to become doctrine in all textbooks, schools, universities, and institutes. Stalin himself supervised the writing and publication in a run of 50 million copies of the famous Short Course, an angry ideological tract that was, in the words of historian Genrikh Joffe, like a hammer pounding nails of falsehood into every schoolboy's and schoolgirl's brain. The Short Course was a textbook of determinist history, with all events leading, necessarily, inexorably, to a glorious conclusion: the rightness and might of the present regime. In such a text, history is free of inner struggles, of ambiguity and choice, of absurdity and tragedy. The big lie always has an unfailing internal logic. Opponents are revealed as enemies of the state, slaughter as necessity. All is clear. All is expressed in the language of myth and epithet. Stalin's rivals for power, Bukharin, Trotsky, and the rest, were White Guard pygmies whose strength was no more than that of a gnat. This was how history, the only history, of the regime was handed down to its subjects. An entire people's understanding of themselves was meant to dwell within this text. To question or defy the dogma was to admit guilt before the criminal code. After Stalin's death in 1953 and the start of Khrushchev's attacks on the personality cult, the Short Course was no longer the catechism. There was a new text, the Revised History of the Communist Party, which made sure to play down the titanic role Stalin had assigned himself. A few historians even seized on the thaw as an opportunity to write more open appraisals of the crimes that Khrushchev had only touched upon. Viktor Danilov, for one, went ahead with work on a pioneering study of the collectivization campaign. But when Brezhnev overthrew Khrushchev in 1964 and slowly began to institute a neo-Stalinist movement, the Grey Cardinal of Ideology, Mikhail Suslov, turned his attention to history. The pendulum swung hard once more to dogma. Brezhnev and Suslov appointed Sergei Trapeznikov, a party historian, apparatchik, as the head of the Central Committee's Department of Science and Educational Establishments, putting him in charge, in effect, of every history textbook and school lesson from Estonia to Sakhalin Island. To make sure the thaw had been thoroughly eliminated from historical studies, Trapeznikov banned Danilov's study of collectivization from publication. In the true Stalinist tradition, Trapeznikov saw collectivization as necessary and just. Trapeznikov decided that the glory of collectivization required a responsible historian. He appointed himself. So complete was the Communist Party's hold over the study of history that nearly all the historical works of any value written in the Soviet Union were by dissidents. Roy Medvedev's Marxist Study of Stalin, Let History Judge, Mikhail Gefter's Essays on Stalinism, and, far greater, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's literary investigation of the camps in the Gulag Archipelago. Medvedev and Gefter, despite their devotion to the revolution and Lenin, were cast to the margins of Soviet society and put under constant watch by the KGB. Brezhnev's attempt to return to Stalin a measure of his former stature would not tolerate apostasy. Solzhenitsyn's trespasses were far greater. He exposed the inherent illegitimacy of the regime and every Soviet leader, including Lenin. This could not be tolerated. In 1974, Solzhenitsyn became the first man forcibly exiled from the country since Trotsky. The repression of dissident writing and study was but a small part of the state apparatus that controlled history. Trapeznikov made sure that the Academy of Sciences, the Institute of History, the Institute of Marxism-Leninism, the universities, the journals, and the schools were all free of other-thinking people. Balts, or Uzbeks, or Ukrainians could not dare suggest that their histories or cultures were somehow different from Russian and Soviet history. That would undermine the myth of a common Soviet fate and Soviet man. All potentially explosive issues, from Lenin's dissolution of the popularly elected Constituent Assembly just after the revolution, to the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, required a stock fairy tale and a neutralized non-language to prevent even the hint of debate or other thinking. When it came to the invasion of Afghanistan, for instance, historians wrote of internationalist duty and the invitation from socialist brethren, or they did not write at all. Only a fool or an ideologue would even think about making the study of Soviet history his profession, said Sergei Ivanov, the Byzantine scholar. Anyone with a genuine interest in history and a sense of honesty made sure to stay as far away from the Soviet period as possible. That's why the only hints of criticism you could read in our scholarship were analogies or metaphors, historians writing about the fall of Constantinople or the French Revolution, or the rise of fascism, and at the same time providing a subtle undertone that maybe a few people would understand. But if you really made Soviet history your field, you were sure to lose, one way or another. Small wonder, then, that the most effective spokesman later on for a radical reform in the study of Soviet history would be Yuri Afanasyev, who had been schooled almost too well in party politics, but whose specialty had been the history of France. Moscow was home to many scholars of the Soviet period, not only Medvedev and Gefter and Afanasyev, but also professional ideologues, cynics, and liars. I spent an astonishing evening at Moscow State University with the head of the history department, Yuri Kukushkin. For hours, Kukushkin, one of the most celebrated time-servers in his profession, a man with close connections to the Central Committee and unusual access to Western books and Soviet archives, went on about how he had had absolutely no idea that Stalin's collectivization campaign had been so costly. Everything in his voice and manner appealed for sympathy, as if he too had somehow been a closet dissident. "I am afraid if I try to speak about what I feel inside, I will fail," Kukushkin said. "Bitterness prevails. If only one man could do it all. If we had access to the documents. We worked in a situation that was like a chemist assigned to make a discovery, cure a disease. But he is only allowed to use the chemicals assigned to him by the keeper of the laboratory. The truth is, I didn't know anyone who knew the real facts and consciously twisted them." But for all his righteous desire to do the right thing, Kukushkin still wanted controls. He wanted the right people to do the scholarly work. "Of course we need balance in our studies, but now we are pouring nothing but sewage on Lenin's bald head," he said. "I am sure our state will survive this. I'm sure Lenin will too. But if a people no longer believes in the future, if they can only see darkness in their common past, then they will go into a state of spiritual dystrophy, and I am not sure we can cure this. In order to inspire faith, we have to show not only the filth and the crime and the blood in our history, but also what there was to be proud of. We are a great and mighty state. We repelled foreign assailants. We must be proud of this. As a man and as a historian,
I am concerned that we do not annihilate ourselves spiritually. Courtesy of Trapeznikov, the academies and universities had been stocked with countless Kukushkins. But there were also men and women like Genrikh Yoffa, who saw themselves somehow as honest, though they knew all too well that the system was too strong, that it mocked their petty attempts to undermine or fool it. Yoffa, the author of many books about the February Revolution and the Romanov dynasty, was in his early 60s. So I was too young to have suffered through the worst deadly assaults on historians under Stalin. But he did receive the standard Stalinist education, the endless drilling in the short course by scared and ignorant teachers. "That was our world, the structure we lived in," he said one afternoon. There was a slight euphoria in the post-war years, a slight thaw, but in 1949-1950, they accused me of being a preacher of bourgeois ideology. Whatever that meant. It turned out that two friends of mine, friends, had stolen a couple of my notebooks. And in my notes on some lecture, I had written in the margin saying, "They must think we are idiots to believe all this." Nothing more. Just a private moment of frustration and doubt. Later on, I couldn't find my notebooks and thought I'd probably lost them somewhere. I didn't pay it much mind. But the next time I saw them was when I had to appear at a public meeting in front of 100 people, students and friends at the university, the Komsomol committee people and all the rest. All my so-called friends were suddenly avoiding me as we walked into the hall. And then, from the podium, the Communist Party secretary pointed at me and cried out, "Look who sits here before us! Yoffa. He thinks you are all idiots." For his sin, Yoffa paid a relatively small price. He was sent to teach in the provincial city of Kostroma until after Stalin's death. Back in Moscow, Yoffa worked at the Lenin Library and began working on his books. "There were certain small things you could do to make yourself feel at least a little honest," he said. "One technique was to introduce foreign sources, and then make sure you criticize the bourgeois falsifiers." I am not sure now that I am ashamed of that. I did manage to amass a lot of material on the February Revolution. Maybe, if I'm very lucky, some readers might have gotten the sense that there was more to the February Revolution than just being an opening act for the October Revolution. Maybe they got the sense that it was the moment that overthrew the monarchy and flirted with a kind of democracy, however weak. But I doubt it. Unfortunately, I compromised too much, and this is hard to bear now. Truthfully, I don't know if the way I negotiated my way through life was a completely conscious choice. I think it was just my nature. By nature, I am a man of compromise, not an extremist. I am not a young man, and to live through these changes, this flood of information, is not easy. I sometimes feel guilty for changing my view of history so quickly. But how can it be otherwise? How can one fail to see what's what? Should I ignore it all for some sort of foolish consistency? I remember the historian Eduard Burdzilov, who had been perhaps the most important historian on the liberal side of things when Khrushchev made his revelations about Stalin in 1956. Before that, Burdzilov had been an inveterate Stalinist, the editor of Culture and Life, which had attacked the Jews, the so-called cosmopolitans. I asked him, how was it possible for a Stalinist, a party careerist, to turn around and change so abruptly? He couldn't answer at first. But then he said, if someone has the chance finally to express himself, to speak the truth, why should he miss the opportunity? The return of history first began with Khrushchev's secret speech denouncing Stalin in 1956.
but the thaw was extremely limited, and as it turned out, reversible. Without a full and careful assessment of the past, one that could not be crammed back into the genie's bottle, real reform, much less democratic revolution, was impossible. Dmitry Yorosov and the Democrats knew it, and Gorbachev knew it too. The return of history to the intellectual and political life of the people of the Soviet Union was the foundation of the great changes ahead. After 2 years of hesitation and the language of avoidance, Gorbachev used 1987 as his moment to begin what Khrushchev had started. He opened the door to history, and he did it first with a movie, then with a speech on the 70th anniversary of the October Revolution. Tengiz Abuladze, a small and elegant man with piercing eyes, lived and made his films in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. By 1980, he had established his reputation as a filmmaker of extraordinary intelligence with two allegorical works, Supplication, which appeared in 1968, and The Wishing Tree in 1977. Meticulous in manner and in his style of work, he spent years thinking and writing, letting his ideas mature, before he shot a single frame. Unlike the musty cave apartments of most Moscow intellectuals, Abuladze's airy house in Tbilisi was a fine place to live and breathe, he said. Over a lunch of Georgian red wine, Stalin's favorite, and the local variation of pizza called kachapuri, Abuladze talked of how he came to make Repentance, a film about the legacy of evil and the moral need for both nation and individual to confront the past. Although television and newspapers were the principal means of the Glasnost explosion, Abuladze's film was the bridge to the recovery of historical memory. More than any other work of the period, Mikhail Shatrov's historical plays, Anatoly Rybakov's and Vladimir Dudentsov's novels, Repentance stunned a people into a state of awareness. The national screenings of Repentance in 1987 and 1988 had such a powerful effect that they can be compared to Lenin's agitprop trains that traveled throughout the provinces, bringing with them portable theaters to show propaganda films on the glory of the Bolshevik Revolution. As an artist or theorist, Abuladze might not be on the same level as the greatest of the